Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your meditative trans-global fusion of music criticism. I'm John Pareles, and I'm with Nate Chenin, our jazz critic, who has spent some interesting conversations recently with the jazz master Charles Lloyd. Hi, Nate.
Hi, John.
Tell us about Charles Lloyd. I'm sure some people listening to this haven't heard of him.
Well, he's a jazz saxophonist and flutist who has had a very unusual career in that he has been a superstar, the first jazz musician to play the Fillmore at a time when that was a very big deal. And he's also been this sort of pioneer of world music, a kind of spiritual seeker. And now at this moment, he's kind of ascended into the ranks of, you know, jazz legend, which interestingly is something that hasn't always been true for him. So that's kind of what this story that I wrote was about, the kind of paradox of how can you be this eminence while also being sort of an underdog.
Well, it seems like he's being rediscovered lately. He's getting the Jazz Heritage Master's Award.
Right. And from the NEA.
Which is the best that you can do as a living jazz musician.
Right.
And he's playing at the Temple of Dendur.
For a second time in 3 years. There's almost a joke there because the Temple of Dendur, you know, which is an Egyptian ruin and has a kind of ancient spiritual connotation. It's a very appropriate place for Charles Lloyd and his music.
Well, why?
His thing has been, from the beginning of his solo career, it's been very searching. It's been in tune with a lot of Eastern mysticism. And then he himself practices the Vedantic, you know, religion and lives, you know, on a bluff in Santa Barbara, very close to his Vedantic temple. And I'm not sure if that was a conscious choice, but it seems like it had to have been. He's just very in tune with the spirit world and has found ways over the years of putting that into his music and really communicating this sort of spiritual utopian ideal.
No, you get a lot of serenity in some of his songs, but he's also really grounded in jazz and blues and rhythm and blues. I mean, he was a jazz crossover star in the late 60s.
Right. And, you know, this was something that I don't think I grasped as fully as I do now before really digging into his story and spending time with him, is the extent to which he was shaped by Memphis and by growing up in the scene that was very connected to rhythm and blues. You know, some of his earliest musical experiences were straight blues, you know, playing with Howlin' Wolf and with B.B. King, Bobby Blue Bland. And his mentor as a kid was Phineas Newborn, who, in addition to, you know, being this sort of Art Tatum-esque piano virtuoso.
Yeah, great two-fisted player.
Yeah, but he was also in this band whose name eludes me, but they were one of the early bands backing B.B. King.
A house band.
They were like a Sun Records house band. And Willie Mitchell was in that band too, you know. So,
wow.
So there's like this connection between jazz and blues and rhythm and blues that is really sort of where he comes from. And that's part of the reason why, you know, when he hit the scene in the 60s and rock musicians started to take interest in him, they realized, oh, here's a guy who, if you're Janis Joplin and you're worshiping the blues, like here's a guy who can tell you stories about Howlin' Wolf from being on the road with him, you know. There's a kind of duality there where he's very airy and he's very sort of spiritual and kind of mystical, but he's also like super earthy in the way that his music operates.
Well, he became a recluse, but he also had a million-selling jazz album with Forest Flower.
Right. Well, so I wanted to ask you, actually, do you remember this moment, this sort of, you know, late 60s moment when Charles Lloyd was someone who was mentioned in the same breath as the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane and sharing bills with these bands? Like, does that ring a bell
for you? Yes. I mean, well, there was this point where all of a sudden the jam bands and people who were discovering blues thought, oh, there's this thing called jazz, Charles Lloyd, Miles Davis, because it was the Bitches Brew era too. I mean, I heard of Charles Lloyd when Forest Flower came out.
Right.
But then He must have not liked fame. He must have wanted not to be that token jazz guy on the rock bill.
Right. Well, so why don't we hear a taste of Forest Flower? Because I feel like that'll set up sort of what we're talking about here.
Forest Flower. So, Nate, when was that? That was the Monterey Jazz Festival?
It was recorded at the 1966 Monterey Jazz Festival. Its impact was felt, you know, throughout the following couple of years. This is a little taste of Forest Flower.
So that was Sorcery, recorded in 1966 by Charles Lloyd. That was pretty out there, Nate.
Well, that's a composition by his pianist in that band, Keith Jarrett.
Oh, I've heard of him.
Yeah. But Keith was in his early 20s. You know, so this is a quartet that Charles Lloyd formed shortly before this Monterey performance. And in addition to Jarrett, it had Cecil McBee on bass and Jack DeJohnette on drums. So this is a band that just had a lot of musical erudition, also this youthful energy and just this fearlessness. In some ways, they carried the energy of the classic John Coltrane quartet, which by this time, you know, was a thing of the past. In a way, they stepped into the place where that band had operated. You know, it really felt like they were carrying on something from that, you know, quartet that people already were starting to miss.
Well, there was both the meditative sense and the wild energy.
Right.
Both of which are tributaries from Coltrane.
And because Lloyd was sort of friends with a bunch of these, you know, rock musicians that were part of this, you know, emerging counterculture, you know, without forcing it, he could sort of speak that language and he could, you know, suggest both the sort of Eastern mysticism and the kind of peace, love, you know, flower power kind of thing. And whatever that sort of that spiritual thing that Coltrane had, that was there too. So it just was a band that struck a chord. And that record became a phenomenon. It was one of the first jazz recordings to sell more than a million copies. The band was the first jazz group to go to the Soviet Union without the help of the State Department. And that was a big, big deal. In 1967, Lloyd was on the cover of Downbeat and they proclaimed him Jazz Man of the Year. But there were, you know, there were grumblings as well. There was a kind of pushback in the jazz establishment because, you know, he was this performer and he did have an image and he was, you know, crossing over.
So he was too popular.
You know, I'm not sure if it was because he was too popular or because people sort of didn't give him credit and felt like he was maybe. In my piece, I quoted a bit of Martin Williams in the New York Times, who was, you know, the part I quoted was making fun of his dress. But he also called him, he said, he usually sounds like a kind of showbiz Coltrane. So this sort of put down where he's not original enough. He's sort of riding coattails.
But at this extremely high level, though, you listen to those albums now, and it's hard to hold on to those coattails.
Right, right. I'll confess that my first, you know, one of the first Charles Lloyd records that I ever heard was Love In, which was recorded at the Fillmore, and this was post Forest Flower. And, you know, Love In's not one of his greatest records.
Or his greatest titles.
Right. And I heard that record, and I thought, oh, you know, maybe this is kind of like a sort of hippy-dippy thing. And it was after that that I realized, like, oh, no, this is very serious. His problem at the time was that things were just happening so fast. The kind of stardom that he had was just stratospheric. You know, there was no real precedent for it in jazz because there was no precedent for it anywhere. Like, the, you know, what was happening? You know, I always think about when Miles Davis played the Isle of Wight Festival and you see those aerial shots of just like an ocean of people. And when I was speaking with Lloyd, he said, yeah, you know, like he has memories of being sort of airlifted by chopper, you know, to a stage in Orange County for 500,000 kids, you know. At the same time, he was partaking in not only the psychedelics of the era, but also, you know,
the stardom,
the narcotics, just everything. And I think at a certain point, he just began to feel like everything was sort of spinning out of control. And at the height of his fame, he made the declaration that, you know, he's done. He's going to retreat. And he moved out to Big Sur and really was not heard from in a, you know, conventional musical career sense for the better part of a decade. And, you know, there have been other instances where jazz musicians step away, but it usually doesn't last that long. And there was really a kind of almost a feeling of finality about it. Like, we may never hear from this guy again.
What made him come back?
Well, it happened in stages. A few people sought him out when he was, you know, living his hermetic lifestyle. And one of them was a young French pianist named Michel Petrucciani, who had a condition known as brittle bone disease. So he was a very small and very fragile person. But he wanted to find Charles Lloyd. He wanted to connect with him. And so they began playing together. He convinced Lloyd to come down from the mountain and make a few appearances. So they played a little bit. There was a record that was put out. And so that was a kind of tentative return. Mm-hmm. But then what happened in 1986, Lloyd had a near-death experience that was based on a rare intestinal disorder. That was part of what led him to realize, like, he really has a sort of burning purpose, actually, and wants to return. And he reconnected with some people, including the drummer Billy Higgins, who was also in California, and put together a band that began releasing records on the ECM label. And for the next 25 years, he was an ECM artist and put out a number of really, really good albums with different configurations. And, you know, that was the beginning of the comeback.
He's always been good with pianists. I mean, not just Keith Jarrett, but Petrucciani.
Right.
Now he's got Jason Moran.
And in between, Bobo Stenson, Jerry Allen, Brad Meldow. He really has this track record. And when I asked him about that, he said that it all goes back to Phineas Newborn. And the way he put it was Phineas planted the seed. And that's sort of the tradition that is, you know, carrying on. He also has pretty serious history with drummers.
Billy Higgins,
Roy Haynes played on his first album as a leader. Before he was a leader, he was working with the Chico Hamilton Quintet as musical director. And then, you know, in addition to Jack DeJohnette, he worked with Billy Hart. And then in 2001, connected with Eric Harland, who is the drummer in the band he calls his new quartet. With Eric Harland, he also formed a trio he calls Sangam. And the third member of that group is the virtuoso tabla genius Zakir Hussain. And I wondered, you know, you're someone who is conversant, deeply conversant and cognizant of world musics. Have you seen this band? Is this
I saw Sangam once, yeah. I'm always kind of suspicious of these world music fusions. It's like, oh, we all play instruments.
Right.
Because there are whole traditions of scales and inflections and modalities that you can't just walk into. You don't want to be playing bebop over an Indian raga.
Right.
I'm really impressed at how much Lloyd has. He's still from Memphis, but he's also now from India. He plays the Hungarian taragato clarinet.
Right.
I mean, he's really dug into these things. It's not superficial.
Yeah.
When did he start doing that? Because that seems to, did that come out of the reclusion? Did that come out of the Vedantic studies?
Well, you know, when he moved to New York in the early 60s, he told me that was a time when, you know, his sort of musical consciousness began expanding. He
other kinds of consciousness too.
Yeah, he talked about listening almost every morning to the Ali brothers, Pakistani music. You know, he was living in a loft on Sheridan Square. You know, he has very fond memories of the sort of early 60s Greenwich Village bohemian life. He began listening to a lot of Indian music, which was, you know, in the air. You know, John Coltrane was very seriously exploring the same thing at that time. But, you know, for a lot of improvisers, they go to a certain point with that. You know, they sort of imbibe of the flavors. They make some casual study of it. But yeah, I think you're right. He made a really deep study and got very serious about, you know, what he calls a kind of universalism of sound. You know, it's in conversation, I spent about 2 hours with him in his hotel room, and he kept returning to this phrase, lines of demarcation. And every time he said it, it was with a kind of distaste, you know, like it was an irritant. This idea that we divide things by genre and style and, you know, sort of social reasons. And to him, in a way, I think racism is a part of that. You know, he talks about things in a very holistic sort of totality. To him, he's always looking for whatever it is that is the common binding force between Indian music and folk music and, you know, rock and roll, blues, jazz. Since his return, you know, he's been back on the scene. But importantly, this new quartet, which formed in 2007, has been working enough that it has sort of had an influence of its own. And I was fascinated to learn that there are some musicians, including this great young pianist, Gerald Clayton, who's on his new record. You know, I asked Gerald about, you know, okay, what's your history with Charles Lloyd and his music? And almost, I just assume that everybody says, oh, well, you know, it's that Keith Jarrett, Jack DeJohnette band, you know. No, with him, it was like, yeah, I saw his band with Jason Moran and Eric Harlan and Ruben Rogers. I saw them in concert a few times, and one time I had tears in my eyes, you know. And so this idea that he's sort of doing the work now. And whatever the language is that he's developed now, like that has had a lot to do with his current stature. And there's a continuum there, but there's also like a new chapter.
Well, do you think that the ideas that he's been playing with have come back into the jazz conversation, or do you think that he was ahead of his time? Because I get two sides of his music. There's the convoluted, complex post-bop harmony, crazy tunes like Sorcery, even though he didn't write that. But there's also this drone meditation open-endedness.
Right.
And he'll do both of those with all of his configurations.
Yeah. I think you asked if he was ahead of his time. I think I have to answer no, because he was so of his time. Mm-hmm. He was so perfectly of that moment. But I do think that some of the values of the kind of like flowing between languages, the freedom when it comes to harmonic expression, the breaking free of like bebop restrictions. And, you know, that makes it sound as if those bebop restrictions are a bad thing. They aren't necessarily inherently. But there is a kind of freedom of expression that I think is very much au courant in the jazz world now. And so the values that he, you know, has sort of always naturally espoused, I think, are in tune with that right now. And it certainly helps that he has, you know, some of the best younger musicians working with him. One of the things, you know, that's just happened is he last month played the Village Vanguard one night only. And it was the first time he'd been there in more than 40 years. His new quartet, we mentioned Jason Moran, Ruben Rogers, Eric Harlan. These are musicians who are in their, I think all of them are now in their early 40s, but very early 40s. And they all grew up with hip hop. They all grew up with, you know, musics that weren't around in the 60s.
Right.
They bring this different energy. It's very fluid. It follows his lead, but it also shapes what happens. And he's totally down with that. You know, when I asked Jason about what happens in the moment when you and Harlan basically lock into a Dilla beat, you know, like how does Charles Lloyd respond to that? And he said, well, you know, he loves to dance, literally and figuratively. Like, this is a man who loves to dance. And so if it grooves, he's there. You know, he's like, word, all right, let's do it.
Well, that's back to Memphis too.
Right, right. Jazz is always at its most alive when there's a conversation between, you know, old and new, between generations. And he has been one of those figures who, as he, you know, reaches elder statesman status, you know, he's very naturally brought in younger musicians and met them where they are, even as they meet him where he is. That's one of the things that's so great.
I get a great sense of happiness, not cerebral stuff, even though there's some very complicated stuff going on. But there's always just this sort of cascade of joy as he's playing.
Yeah.
I mean, he's upbeat. There's not a lot of tragedy in there.
I think that's fully intentional. That brings us to his new record, which is is his first proper album, I think, on Blue Note. He was courted by Don Was, who was one of those teenaged forest flower fanatics back in the day. Don Was, when he became president of Blue Note, and he told me this, basically Charles Lloyd was like at the top of his list for, you know, we got to get him. You know, it was Charles Lloyd and Wayne Shorter. Those were the two guys. And they're both now on Blue Note. But this record was, it was a commission by a European festival. So he wrote a suite in addition to a quartet with, and this one has Gerald Clayton on piano, Joe Sanders on bass, and Gerald Cleaver on drums. So it's a different quartet. But he also has a musician playing the politiki lyra, which is a kind of pear-shaped Greek lute that is played with a bow. And he also has someone on Hungarian cymbalom, which is a hammered dulcimer. And
so the third man.
Right, right. So these are, you know, these are sort of instruments that are connected to folk antiquity.
Well, also both of those instruments have fixed scales.
Right, right.
That are different from the scale on the piano.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting how he incorporates them into the music, and it works really well, I think. And this is something that he'll be revisiting when he plays the Temple of Dendor on April 18th, a few days after the release of the record.
What's it called?
The album's called Wild Man Dance.
So he's still dancing.
He's still dancing. There's a kind of spiritual connotation to the title. You know, he talks about the wild man as this kind of, there's a good wild man and a bad wild man. And, you know, it's about sort of tapping into the good wild man while taming the bad one. You know, it is a joyful record, and it's a record that definitely bridges cultures, and, you know, it feels very alive, and it feels very sort of imbued with his specific kind of energy.
Well, when you talked with him, was he way out there? Was he practical? Was he, what kind of feeling did you get from him?
He's an extremely discursive conversationalist. He's somebody who will begin to answer a question, take a sideways swerve. Suddenly you find yourself, you know, in the realm of parable. You know, you'll wind through some recollection, and in the middle of a sentence, you'll be in another sentence. But he somehow finds his way back. At one point, we were talking about, you know, the village, and he was reminiscing about a story that he had when he shared a dressing room with Thelonious Monk at the at the village gate. You know, he was talking about Monk and the Baroness Nika von Königswater, and all of a sudden we were talking about the Tibetan monk Milarepa. Those two things were inexorably linked in his mind. It was like Monk story, village gate, Milarepa, Tibetan Buddhism. Yes, it's all wrapped up there. You have to kind of just like grab on and go for the ride. But I found, especially as I revisited the conversation, I found like, wow, he always comes back. You know, it's sort of loopy and kind of wild, but he does make sense.
So it's like one of his solos.
It is kind of like one of his solos.
Why don't we listen to one of his new tracks?
This is a part of a piece called River from Wild Man Dance. And water imagery and sort of the spiritualism of water is really important to Lloyd. And so I think this track, both structurally and thematically, is a centerpiece of the suite.
So, Nate, he fled all this back at the end of the 60s, and now he's really back in the thick of it. He's got younger musicians praising him. He's all over the place. I mean, how do you think he's taking to this new emeritus status?
It's complicated because I think he's very guarded about succumbing to craving. It's part of his spiritual practice. You know, you renounce all cravings. And I think the craving for fame and for success is one of those things that he tries to hold at arm's length. At the same time, who doesn't want to feel appreciated? And when I brought up the issue of validation, this NEA Jazz Master's Award, it's a high honor. You know, it was a simple question. I said, how do you feel about this? And he got unexpectedly emotional. He actually got choked up at one point and started crying. I don't know whether that was in a direct response to the idea of reputation or just sort of how moved he is that younger musicians and fans continue to respond the way that they do. One thing he said was, you know, in my spiritual life, I've learned that you go up on the rooftop and you make the call and, you know, your people will come find you. He's embodied that idea. You know, he has not really wavered in the way that he makes music. Like if you listen to stuff he did with the Chico Hamilton Quintet and stuff he did on his early records, you can really draw a line from that to what he does now. And the context has changed around him a lot. I think his sound has changed a little. But he's somebody who has had a pretty clear compass. And so I do think that it means something to him that he hasn't been forgotten and that he's still relevant. As long as he continues to work with musicians who are as vital as, you know, the ones he has now, and as long as they continue to feel like this is something with a purpose, I think he's going to continue to be important.
And he's keeping up with those young guys. There is no lessening of energy from his horn.
No, he still sounds absolutely vital.
Well, thank you, Nate, for being here. Nate Chenin, our jazz critic. Let's go back to 1966 and a little more Forest Flower Sunrise.
Peace out.
That's this week's New York Times podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm John Pareles. Nate Chenin was our guest. You can read Nate's fantastic interview with Charles Lloyd in the Sunday paper, Arts and Leisure section, or at nytimes.com music. We have a Spotify playlist of Charles Lloyd through the decades. Our producers are Jeremy Egner and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and we'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.